From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, The Irish in America, a new PBS series chronicling the Irish immigrant experience begins tonight. It examines the discrimination the Irish faced here after fleeing the potato famine and the institutions they helped build here. We'll talk with Peter Quinn, who's a contributor to the companion book and is interviewed for the series. Also, we talk with Irish film director and screenwriter Jim Sheridan. His new movie, The Boxer, is about a former IRA member who returns home after 14 years in prison. Once again, Sheridan teams up with actor Daniel Day-Lewis. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews a new CD by singer-songwriter Victoria Williams, her first CD in 3 years. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Clinton shook his finger at television cameras today and again declared he never committed improper behavior with White House intern Monica Lewinsky.
I did not have sexual relations with that woman, Miss Lewinsky. I never told anybody to lie, not a single time, never. These allegations are false, and I need to go back to work for the American people.
First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton stood at his side. The president did not go into detail. He left the room without taking questions. One of Northern Ireland's pro-British paramilitary groups has withdrawn from peace talks today. Its outlawed paramilitary wing has admitted murdering 3 Catholics. The Ulster Democratic Party, the lawful representative of the outlawed Ulster Defense Association, didn't wait for the British and Irish governments to decide whether the LDP would be forced out of the peace talks. NPR's Michael Goldfarb says the announcement was made by the LDP's leader, Gary McMichael.
The mood at the morning session when all the participating parties gave their viewpoints on whether they should be allowed to stay in or not was clearly against their continued participation. The two governments, the Irish and the British government, will ultimately make that decision. He said that the mood was very clear and that the UDP would not stay to be humiliated by a decision by the governments to throw them out. So they have left.
NPR's Michael Goldfarb at the Northern Ireland peace talks at Lancaster House in London. The departure of the Ulster Democratic Party has raised fears that there will be even more attacks against Northern Ireland's minority Catholic population. Opening statements are underway in the state of Minnesota's lawsuit against the tobacco industry. NPR's Debbie Elliott reports from St. Paul. In other news, the government says sales of previously owned homes fell slightly in December, but 1997 was still a record year. The National Association of Realtors says sales of existing homes dropped 2.1% in December, but for all of 1994, 4.2 million existing homes were sold. That's 3% better than in 1996. The association says strong home demand was fueled by strong job creation and by low mortgage rates. A group of business economists says the economy will continue to expand moderately for the first half of this year. The National Association of Business Economists says that was also true of the last quarter of 1997. The association's latest survey finds wages and costs were unchanged at most firms. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up more than 23 points at 7,724. Trading's active. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, as the Tokyo stock market soared today, prosecutors raided the country's powerful finance ministry on allegations of bribery among officials who inspect Japan's banks. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports.
In the latest blow to the prestige of Japan's financial policies, about 50 prosecutors descended on the offices and homes of the finance ministry's banking inspectors. They searched for evidence that financial institutions had entertained government officials in exchange for confidential information about the finance ministry's bank inspections. Japanese banks are heaving under the weight of bad debt that totals nearly $600 billion, and some banks have a powerful interest in concealing the extent of their their compliance with things such as adequate capital ratios. If they do not meet international standards, they can be shut down. Police are investigating whether officials who were given expensive golf outings and other entertainment did so in exchange for lenient oversight of the banks. This is Julie McCarthy, NPR News, Tokyo.
AT&T Corporation says it had an 18% decline in its fourth quarter profits in 1997. The nation's largest telecommunications firm earned $1.3 billion in that time period, down from $1.62 billion from the year before. But the report was stronger than expected. This afternoon, the new chairman of AT&T is expected to announce a major realignment of management and staff. About 15,000 people are expected to be laid off from AT&T. Again on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up more than 23 points at 7,724. Trading's active. I'm Korva Coleman, National Public Radio in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, putting a world of knowledge within your reach with over 200 locations across America. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Tonight, public television begins a three-part series called The Irish in America, Long Journey Home. America is a country of immigrants, and the Irish, who were escaping the potato famine of the 1840s, were the first to arrive here in large numbers, poor and hungry. The anti-immigration movement of today has its roots in the anti-Irish sentiment of the mid-1800s. The TV series and its companion book follow the Irish in America, the discrimination they faced, and the institutions they helped build that transformed America. My guest Peter Quinn is one of the people interviewed for the series, and he's a contributor to the companion book. His novel, The Banished Children of Eve, is about the Irish in New York City during the Civil War. Three of Quinn's grandparents were from rural Ireland. The schools he attended while growing up in the Bronx were founded by the Irish who arrived here during the famine.
I spent a large part of my life groping back to these my own roots in the Irish famine. My first ancestor arrived in New York in 1847, Michael Manning, as a dispossessed Irish farmer. And we eventually, after 50 years on the Lower East Side, moved to the Bronx and the great New York immigration upwards and out. And then in 1970, I was a Vista volunteer in Kansas City, intending to go to California and shake off the dust of the Bronx and New York from my feet forever. But it was at that point that I turned around and began to wonder about the whole experience of my family, about where we had come from. I had the sense I'm at the end of a long process, and I didn't know what the process was about. So that I eventually came back to New York and went to Fordham University in the Bronx to get a graduate degree in Irish history to begin to explore this whole experience, which I knew very, very little about.
What did you think it meant to be Irish before you started doing a lot of research about Irish history?
Well, it was a very simple definition when I was growing up in the Bronx. It was you voted Democratic and went to Mass. To be Catholic and Democratic was the essence of being Irish. I never heard, in my family, we were not talking about Yeats and Joyce and the Irish Renaissance. I never heard my parents mention their names.
Well, you know, you've mentioned in one of your articles that your family never seemed to have any artifacts or memorabilia or anything left over from Ireland. And in fact, none of the kids who you know had families that had anything remaining from their lives in Ireland. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah. Well, anybody I knew from the famine immigration, whose family had come in the 1840s, they didn't have, I don't even have a village name, really. There was no stick of furniture. There were no artifacts or relics or things passed down from one generation to the other. There were barely any stories passed down from one generation to the other. And when I began to go back, you know, the famine experience had been, it's so central to the Irish psyche, to who the Irish are today on both sides of the Atlantic. And I began to see that there was this, you know, where had it gone? Where had the experience gone?
What do you think it was? You think it was, like, so painful people wanted to forget about it? I'm reminded, for instance, I think in a lot of Jewish families that came from Eastern Europe, you know, you don't talk about the old country.
Yeah, there was there was the necessity of getting on. Just I don't think it was a conscious decision. Well, let's erase history, but it was the circumstances that people were under. They weren't educated. We're talking about the lowest economic levels of Irish society that wound up crowded together in American cities. It was a matter of survival, And I also think it was not something parents were passing on to their children. There was a great humiliation of the Irish that went on the famine. They couldn't feed themselves, and the British government at some point decided that the best thing would be to clear the land, that the famine would become an instrument of social engineering, that there could be no economic progress in Ireland unless these people were cleared away. The whole journey off the land, many cases of evicted, into ships where they were mistreated, into cities where they were hated, this is not something that becomes part of the folk memory where you're passing it on and saying, you should remember this.
It's interesting. I think now Americans think of the Irish Catholics as being, white Americans. And what's so distinctive about it? But there was a time when the Irish came here and they were seen as very different and very inferior and very much to be hated.
Well, I think it's almost impossible for us. I remember going to California and giving a talk about my book and explaining this perception of the Irish Catholic. I mean, you're talking about a Northern European white Christian ethnic group in the 19th century who were regarded as racially different from the rest of America. Now, that's almost hard to believe, but Irish Catholics were perceived not as a kind of different religious group. They were perceived racially, that they were racial characteristics. You have Charles Loring Brace, the founder of the Children Aid Society in New York, and he writes a book in 1863 called Races of the Old World, and he talks about Irish skull size, brain size, that their brain was between that of an Englishman and an African. It seems almost laughable now, but, we have the bell curve. We've transferred the measurement from measuring people's, the size of their cranium, to these absolute standards, supposedly, of IQ. But they always come up with the same result, that the poorest levels of society are not as bright as the richest levels of society. That's the iron rule of intelligence testing.
Do you think another thing that kind of aroused the fears of people in America toward the Irish was that there were so many of them coming at the same time, like, they're going to take over. They're going to change the complexion of the United States.
Yes. Well, I think I don't want to just say that the people who reacted to the Irish were just making it all up. You had this sudden descent of rural people unprepared for urban life on American cities. Really, you have all these consequences of it: poverty, violence, the essence of city life in American cities changes. In 1847, Boston's a city of 100,000 people. You have 30,000 people arrive in 1 year. So that they did change the nature of American cities. They did add all these different elements. You really have two parallel, I think, experiences in American history where that happens. The African-American immigration to northern cities and the Irish immigration. There are a lot of similarities between those two events. They do change the nature of American cities.
When the Irish came to the United States after the famine, there were no self-help groups in place for them. There were no government programs to ease their transition to American cities. They had to help each other. What are some of the ways that they had of doing that, some of the groups that they built to help each other?
One of the groups that they built at the foundation of the United States is the American labor movement. Right away, they're organizing unions in cities, and they don't have an experience of entrepreneurial capitalism. They're not so-called entrepreneurs. They're not shopkeepers. The villages they come from don't have shops. They don't have this business tradition. They have the tradition of sticking together, which rapidly translates into unions. They also, with the Catholic institutions, the start of orphanages, the Foundling Hospital in New York, the Catholic Protectory, which in Westchester, which is now part of the Bronx, there's a movement in American society. One of the things called the placing out system, which begins in 1857, when they begin to take children, when children are brought to the courts, they're taken from their homes and sent west in these orphan trains, which go on for years and years. And in the beginning of these orphan trains, they're almost all Irish American. And it's really Catholic nuns who began to organize against that in New York City and to start these orphanages and asylums that Catholic children will be tended for in their own institution. And it's these Catholic nuns who eventually, working with Irish politicians, begin to demand that there be support by the state for institutions for the poor.
How did the Irish become so identified with the Democratic Party?
The Republican Party tended to be the party of business and individualism. The Democratic Party, because of its position in the cities, some Democratic bosses like Fernando Wood in New York City was the first person to realize that, you know, these people have the vote. Also, the Democratic Party adopted the position of pro-immigration. There were members of the Republican Party, like the governor of New York, Governor Seward, who he toyed with the idea. He wanted to get the Republican Party to become more pro-immigration and try to attract the Irish, but that's not what happened.
I think the schools that you went to as a boy in the Bronx were schools that were started by the Irish who came after the potato famine.
The parish I'm from, St. Raymond's on Tremont Avenue, was started in 1848 and was a direct consequence of the Irish potato famine.
So did you feel like, in retrospect, that a lot of the institutions around you when you were growing up related to the famine, to the people who came from the famine?
I came to understand that the institutions that formed, and we all tend to think that the institutions have always been there. And as I began this exploration of my own background, I was fascinated by the fact of the dates of the start of these schools that I had gone to. That I was being taught, really, by institutions founded with the attitudes, with the sensibilities of the famine Irish. 120 years later, it hadn't gone away. It was still there. It still had a presence and effect that I had never been able to judge before or realize.
My guest is Peter Quinn. He's a contributor to the book The Irish in America and the companion PBS series, which begins tonight. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Peter Quinn, one of the experts interviewed in the PBS series The Irish in America, which begins tonight. Well, you know, the biggest cliche about the Irish is that it's a drinking culture. You know, even like what's an Irish dinner, a six-pack and a potato or something?
A seven-course Irish dinner is a boiled potato and a six-pack. That's
there you go, right. Thank you. Anyways, but how did that become the stereotype, drinking and the Irish saloons as the big gathering place? I should mention here, I think your grandfather owned a saloon.
My grandfather owned a saloon on 11th Street in Dry Dock, which is now Shoal Place in Lower Manhattan.
Uh-huh.
The effect of alcohol on the Irish, part of it was the anesthetizing themselves against the pain that they went through. In the 19th century America, just a simple example, canal workers used to be given a ration of whiskey every day because the work was so brutal. And that was a part of the Irish experience of the trauma of Irish history, you know, the self-medical help that alcohol is. The way the poor today, you know, with drug abuse, I don't think it's much different. But there's another element to saloon life in Irish culture, which is this accent on the Irish on sociability, on talk, on music. And that the saloon was that, too. It just wasn't a place to drink. It was a labor bureau. It was a social club. It was a place where people talked, where politics was done. Almost all the ward healers in New York, and probably Chicago too, although I'm not from Chicago, were saloon keepers. They didn't have these other fraternal organizations. They didn't have these high-class clubs. They had the saloon, which is where they met and talked and sang and carried all these social habits that had existed in the Irish villages, the clachan in Ireland. One of the things I think the Irish are the first immigrant group to do, and this has been done since by other immigrant groups, is they recreate the village and the city. They just don't come to cities and disappear and become lost and disoriented. They are like that when they arrive, but they quickly organize the village in the city, the parish and the saloon. When I was growing up in the Bronx, nobody ever said they were from the Bronx or Metropolitan Avenue or Kingsbridge. They were from a parish. You were from St. John's. St. Nicholas of Tallentine, St. Helena's, St. Raymond's. That's how you identified yourself. And to an extent, people still do that.
What do you know about your grandfather's saloon?
I know that my grandmother wanted him to get out of it, that she didn't. She said there was never an honest dollar made across a bar, and that he didn't make a lot of money at it, unfortunately, and that in a act of business astuteness, which my family has always been good at, he sold the real estate he owned in Manhattan and moved to the Bronx. So... I still have a day job because of that kind of forward thinking.
Really?
But my great, you know, my father was in politics. My father was a judge in New York. And his ambition for my brother and I was to get civil service jobs. That was the great accent in Irish families. My family wasn't alone in that. And in parochial schools, too. You know, there was one of the consequences of the famine, one of the consequences of this absolute lack of any security was this almost obsession with it, that I had a B.A. from college, and my father, I took the court officer's test in New York, and I became a court officer, and I went up to his chambers, and I said, I want to leave and go back and go to graduate school. And he said, you never leave a civil service job. You stay in the civil service job and get the pension, then you do whatever you want, but you never leave a civil service job. And that sense of security was a very prevalent part of Irish urban experience, of seeking security, of ensuring you or your family will never starve again.
And how did you explain to him that you were leaving the civil service job?
Well, I hate to admit this at my maturity, but I didn't explain to him. I stayed until he died.
Really?
Yeah. He died in 1974. I had this conversation with him in 1972. I said, I want to go back to graduate school and study Irish history. And he said, that's when he told me, absolutely not. You never leave a civil service job. And when he died 2 years later, I quit the civil service job.
Had you stayed out of respect for him or out of trust in his opinion?
Both. You know, his father had seen the tail end of the famine in Tipperary. And then my father lived through the Great Depression. And he would always tell a story to my brother and me when we were boys of being in Foley Square and seeing 3,000 men lined up to take the court officer's test. That part of what the stories he had been told about the famine, he had transferred to the Depression. That, you know, so there was not a lot of accent in Irish families, at least any that I knew, about going out into the business world. My father and his father kind of regarded it as a very suspect activity.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Peter Quinn, and he's written about Irish history in America in his novel, The Banished Children of Eve. He's a contributor to the new book, The Irish in America, which is a companion to the new PBS series called The Long Journey Home, The Irish in America, and he's one of the people interviewed for that PBS series. Your novel, The Banished Children of Eve, which came out a few years ago, is about a really interesting but very obscure for most people chapter in American history that has to do with the draft during the Civil War. Tell us a little bit about this, because I think most people really don't know about this draft riot.
Well, the granddaddy of all American riots to this day is the draft riots in New York in July 1863. Three times as many people died in the draft riots in New York in 1863 as in Los Angeles in 1992. It remains the single greatest instance of American urban violence. It spread all across the city. The police lost control of it. The militia lost control of it. Finally, they had to bring the regiments back from Gettysburg, and they fought pitched battles in the New York streets on 2nd Avenue and 3rd Avenue, not far from here. They had cannons lined up. If you look at the lithographs, it looks like the Battle of the Paris Commune. It was an extraordinary event in American history.
What was it about?
It was about the imposition of the military draft that had happened the first time in American history that the government said, we're not going to just rely on volunteers, that we're going to draft people. And they created two exemptions to the draft. One was you could send a substitute in your place and be excused from any further drafts, or you could pay $300 and send a substitute, and that would excuse you from that round of the draft. In the Irish slums of New York and in other places, $300 was a working wage for a year. And you're dealing with the people only 8 years away from the end of the famine immigration. You're dealing with this mass of people who arrived in the eastern cities of the United States who perceive the Anglo-American aristocracy that was here as the same aristocracy they had dealt with in Ireland. It's almost impossible to understand the draft riots outside the context of Irish history, especially the date that it starts. It starts on July 13th, which is the day after Orangeman's Day, which was a day of great violence and still is in Northern Ireland, and a significant date in Irish history.
So the poor Irish were angry at this draft law, which said that people who had more money than they did could get out of the draft.
Yes.
Or people who had more connections than they did could get out of the draft.
Yes.
And they were, they did they not also want to fight for a country that they just landed in and they were at the very bottom of?
Well, large numbers of the Irish did fight. There was the Irish Brigade, which had a regiment from New York. The Irish fought in large numbers in the Union Army. But there was also this resentment in the Irish slums in July of 1863. The draft riots turned, they are the social explosion. They are like the Paris Commune in some ways. They're also a race riot. The Irish people in the city turn their anger up to the people next to them, which are African Americans, who African Americans are, you know, the oldest ethnic group in New York City with the Dutch. And in many cases, the Irish had, because they were so poor, they undercut African Americans in the lowest jobs in the cities. They would work for less. But by the summer of 1863, their perception was, with abolition, we're being drafted to fight to free the slaves, and they're going to come and take our jobs. That was the kind of one of the bottom line resentments of the riots. Of, you know, and it's not the end of this in American history. Groups in cities struggling against each other for what's left at the bottom.
You grew up in the Bronx. What's your old neighborhood like now?
My old neighborhood is largely Spanish. The Catholic Church is still there. That's the institution that hasn't gone away. The public school is Spanish. It's another immigrant group replacing the Irish. I remember early on in writing the book, The Banished Children of Eve, I was down on Grand Street, and my ancestors had been at a parish there, St. Mary's, and the church is still there. And I was just kind of curious. I had this, this name of the parish. I had never been in it, and it's an immigrant area. And I went in to the church. It was built in the 1830s. And I went to the Easter services, and I sat there, and there were mostly people from the Dominican Republic, poor people. And I sat in the back of the church, and I said, you know, these people, this is what it looked like in the 1840s. It's not all that different here. It's another language. They were speaking Spanish. They were dressed poorly. They looked different. And, you know, I said, this is, if somebody had wandered in this church 140 years ago, this is what they would have seen. And my great hope, people have said, you know, the book is a story of the Banished Children of Eve, violence and rioting and this great urban upheaval. But to me, it gave me a lot of hope. I said, if the famine Irish could go through all this, cause all these problems, survive all this misery, and come out the better for it at the end, and New York City and American society come out stronger because of it, then we have tremendous reason to hope.
Well, Peter Quinn, I really want to thank you a lot.
Okay, thank you.
Peter Quinn is one of the experts featured in the PBS series The Irish in America, which begins tonight and continues Tuesday and Wednesday. He also contributed to the companion book. Quinn's novel about the Irish in New York City during the Civil War is called Banished Children of Eve. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
For tapes or transcripts of Fresh Air, please call toll-free anytime, 1-888-NPR-NEWS. Also, Fresh Air interviews are now available online at www.audible.com/freshair.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, a new film about the Troubles in Northern Ireland. We talk with James Sheridan, director of The Boxer, starring Daniel Day-Lewis as a former IRA member who returns home after 14 years in prison. And Ken Tucker reviews Victoria Williams' first CD in 3 years. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Troubles in Northern Ireland is the backdrop for the latest film by my guest, director and screenwriter Jim Sheridan. The film stars Daniel Day-Lewis, who also starred in Sheridan's films My Left Foot and In the Name of the Father. Daniel Day-Lewis plays Danny Boy Flynn, a boxer and former IRA member who's just gotten out of prison after 14 years. He's now disillusioned with the IRA. In fact, his ambition is to create a non-sectarian boxing gym. He's still in love with Maggie, who he was in love with when he went to prison, and she still loves him. But during his long absence, she married his best friend, and they had a son. Now her husband is in prison, and the IRA expects prisoners' wives to remain loyal and supportive no matter what. The pressures on her to stay away from Danny are especially intense because her father is an IRA leader. Here's Maggie, played by Emily Watson, and Maggie's father, played by Brian Cox.
My marriage was over before Liam was even born. I'm the prisoner here. You and your politics have made sure of that.
All I wanted was for you to have a good marriage.
Like you and my mother?
Yes.
Do you know how much it cost her to smile every time you walked through the front door? And she lived her whole bloody life worried to death. And for what? Will you look me in the eye and tell me for what?
I suppose she believed in me, Maggie.
She thought the ground that you walked on was sacred. So did I. I'm not going to lose Donnie.
Then you'll have to tell him to go.
Why?
I can't protect him, Maggie. You'll have to get rid of him. Or you'll find him in a pool of blood.
God help you.
I asked director Jim Sheridan if the IRA does pressure the wives of prisoners to remain loyal to their husbands no matter what.
Especially within such a small community as the nationalist community in Belfast and Derry, it is the, you know, expected. And I mean, there's a lot of prisoners, so there's a lot of people in the community who are related to them. And it's just a, it's like a communal acceptance, you know. I think it would be true of a lot of societies, not just Catholic Northern Ireland, you know, that the women would be expected to be faithful, you know.
But you wouldn't necessarily be punished as severely by your whole community if you weren't in other settings, perhaps.
No, but it's, you know, in this situation, it's like the morale of the army depends on,
right,
you know, faithful and loyal and secretive and, you know. So if there's somebody who's disloyal, whether it's a woman or what, it kind of undermines the morale of the army. So it's kind of looked upon as kind of a deeper betrayal than just a sexual betrayal.
I understand that you initially planned to make a movie about Barry McGuigan, who was, I think, world featherweight champion in 1985.
Yeah.
You know, a real boxer who you were going to do a biography of. How did you get from there to the fictional boxer played by Daniel Day-Lewis in your movie?
Well, I think the difficulty with making Barry's story, you know, Barry's a Catholic married to a Protestant, all the cliches you can ever imagine, you know. And the difficulty is it's not really true that Catholics and Protestants have a difficulty marrying. It's more that they have a difficulty staying together in one or other society, you know. But it's not very dramatic. And when it is dramatic, it tends towards the sentimental. So we avoided that. And then there were so many issues in relation to Barry's true story that I just couldn't make. And I suppose in the end of the day, I was more interested in the love story of the, you know, the prisoner's wife and the boxer than anything else. And I was interested in the, in kind of drawing a line in the sand in relation to violence, you know.
Daniel Day-Lewis plays the boxer in your movie. I know he's very obsessive when it comes to preparing for roles. What did he do to become a boxer?
He spent 3 years training with Barry McGuigan.
The boxer whose story you were originally going to play.
Yeah, he spent a year with him, but he spent 3 years with a friend of mine who's out here in Los Angeles called Michael Toho, who is in the film as the Protestant lad who comes to the gym, or who he meets in the Protestant territory and goes to London with him. And Mick Toll was like Irish flyweight champion for 6 years in succession as an amateur. And he trained with Daniel for all through In the Name of the Father. And, you know, they were great friends, and he started training Daniel, and then Barry McGuigan took it over and trained him for a couple of years, and then they got into intensive training for about a year before the film start was made.
So I guess he had to be pretty sure you were really going to make this movie if he was training for that long.
No, he's not like that, Daniel. He's very odd. He would never say to you, oh, I have to make a boxing movie. He would just kind of intimate that he was interested in boxing by training away, you know. I knew he wanted to make a boxing film, you know, but that was about the extent of it.
So did he know that you were making this movie before he started training?
No, not necessarily. I don't think so. He knew I was interested in a film about Barry, and he started training with Barry, you know, so it's like...
Oh, I see. So he figured you were eventually going to do this, but he didn't know for sure, but he started training anyways.
Yeah,
just
exactly.
In case.
Now you have it.
All right. Now, you have a few boxing scenes, and of course, you know, the greatest of the contemporary boxing movies is Raging Bull. So did you study Raging Bull, and if so, what did you get from that?
Well, you know, I studied Raging Bull a lot, and I mean, but you have to, you know. It's like probably the best film of the 80s in many ways, you know. Certainly the critics have said so. And, you know, it's a very, there are very powerful fight sequences in it and that. And, you know, it's about a kind of very aggressive boxer. And when I watched it, you know, I think, oh my God, he's done everything Scorsese. I can't repeat any of that, you know. I went for a totally different approach, you know, much more closer to the documentary reality of boxing. And, you know, there's probably very specific differences. I mean, in that film, they were using the kind of brutalization to show you the, you know, an almost an operatic style to show you the interior mentality of Jake LaMotta, you know, and they did it brilliantly and used a lot of slow motion. I didn't actually use any slow motion. And I just used it once in the film at the end, and for a very different purpose, which was that I wanted to use the slow motion to show non-violence, you know.
What do you mean to show non-violence?
Well, it's at the moment where he doesn't kill the guy that the slow motion is used. And it's to it's to slow down the speed of the boxing and show the kind of his mental, his thoughts, you know, what the audience expect. Once you go into slow motion, the audience expect the guy to get killed, you know.
Right, just to explain here, there's a match going on, and the other boxer, the boxer Daniel Day-Lewis is fighting against, has been knocked out several times. He can't even barely stand up. He's obviously, like, lost, yet the referee insists that the fight continue. So Daniel Day-Lewis is expected to keep punching him, but he won't do it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to give away the film, but that basically,
right, okay.
That's it. And but it's like, you know, I think from thinking about it and that, and, you know, like if there's a car accident in the road and people slow down to see it, you wonder, why do they do that? And I think many times it's just like a tribal thing of looking at the accident and seeing how you can avoid it. You know, it's somewhere deep to try and learn lessons, you know, and kind of the certainty that you're still alive and the fear that the others may be dead. And in the cinema, that happens a lot. You know, the audience seem to have a huge acceptance for people dying, you know, and being shot apart and blown up. And I always try to figure, I was trying to figure out what is it. And the only kind of conclusions I could come up with, that it's kind of like us watching violence on the screen, especially in slow motion, is like a low-level quest for immortality, you know. It's like we sit there thinking, oh, they're all dying, and now I'll watch it in slow motion, and we feel it, never feel more alive. But it's a false feeling. It's a false feeling of immortality.
My guest is director and screenwriter Jim Sheridan. His latest movie is The Boxer. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jim Sheridan, director and co-writer of The Boxer, which stars Daniel Day-Lewis as a boxer and former IRA member who's just gotten out of prison after 14 years. Let me ask you about another scene. There's a scene, I won't give away any of the story here, but I'll just say that there's a riot that breaks out, you know, yeah, because of sectarian violence. Mm-hmm. And it's a riot that starts in the gym and spreads to the streets. And it's just mm-hmm. chaos. And it's an incredibly well shot and directed scene, I think. Mm-hmm. And you really get a sense of being in the crowd and being mm-hmm. Like afraid and lost and out of control. Yeah. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about directing that scene and creating that kind of chaos that where everything erupts yeah. and there's no way out.
Little guy in school, you know, the smallest kid in the class kind of vibe. You know, it's like when you're small in a crowd, you know, especially as a kid. So I used a kid's perspective, you know, with his father picks him up and then puts him on his shoulders and then the kid has a perspective above the crowd, you know, but it's only because he's in a weak position and he falls. So I'm interested in that, you know, I really am. I'm interested in when the crowd becomes massive violence, you know. I mean, I've been chased in Ireland in riot situations and that, you know, and it's kind of really is scary. And you just, you know, everything goes except the immediate things around you, you know, like feet flying along. And so I was very interested in the way the violence has its own logic, you know. And you know, you see that every day. People lose their temper. You see it on a personal level and, you know, the violence overcomes them. Well, there's a mass thing that it happens like that too, you know, and for very many different reasons. Sometimes, you know, tiredness get people going. Sometimes, but we all have the little demon in our child with the rage ready to, you know, let loose.
Did you ever get hurt in a riot either by cops, soldiers, or by just the crowd itself?
No, I saw the funniest thing was, I was in being chased by the cops once, and, you know, and the policeman fell and broke his leg, which was scary, you know?
How do you know he broke his leg?
Because I went back to look, you know.
Why did you go back?
Because, like, because the police then more or less stopped and, you know, had chased the crowd as far as they could go and battered a few on the head. And then, you know, we stopped and just walked back. It was just, I suppose, kind of, I don't know, concern. They were Irish police. It was outside the British Embassy, you know, in Dublin. And, you know, it was suddenly your own police battering you. It's kind of a very weird situation, you know. It was.
So you felt ambivalent about being in conflict with them in the first place?
I felt ambivalent about being in the situation because we went to protest about Bloody Sunday and then some idiot burnt the embassy, you know. They threw petrol bombs and the whole place went up, you know. And that was my first example of where there's a protest that could lead to change being dissipated by, you know, a violence which is like a cheap, easy, lazy way of conducting dissent.
Where are you from in Ireland?
I'm from Dublin.
So did the Troubles have much of an impact on your family growing up in the South?
Well, no, but my mother was from the North and she was always very influential in my life. And, you know, when the North blew up, she took in all these lodgers from the North of Ireland, you know, more or less refugees and, you know. And yeah, it did have an influence, yeah. And, you know, but I think basically it's not like that. I think what happened in Ireland was that the television came along and the television basically changed the Irish landscape. You know, the first people saw Martin Luther King marching in America, you know, for civil rights, and then the Irish copied it. That's what happened. That's how the trouble in the North started. We were copying you guys here, you know. And the strange irony was people were marching for civil rights in Ireland in a country that didn't even have a Bill of Rights. So it was kind of contradictory, but people didn't care about that because it was on television, you know. And And television then had a huge influence on that. Once the police battened the civil rights marchers, it became more violent, and then Bloody Sunday happened and it became really violent. And then they closed down the television, you know, and wouldn't allow the IRA or anybody for their representatives on. And, you know, they tried to control the war that way. Which you can understand. I mean, they had great difficulty. But I think one of the things in which I haven't heard anybody commenting on was that, you know, what they didn't have in Ireland in the civil rights, not as far as I know, maybe there was one person who couldn't rise to the occasion, but they didn't have a leader like Martin Luther King who had a spiritual dimension that was inclusive of the other side. The spiritual depth or whatever. And I think that was lacking in the Irish civil rights marches, which just were kind of almost like an immediate response to what they'd seen abroad.
Did you have friends in the IRA, and did their stories affect your view of the Troubles?
Yeah, it'd be hard not to have friends in the Republican movement. And this is not, I'm not dissembling here when I have tried to think, did I have friends? I did have friends in the IRA who were arrested in the early years. And, you know, because like thousands of kids were just picked up without trial and, you know, then they all joined the IRA. And I knew quite a few of them. But as the conflict went on, it got down into a hard nucleus of very tough guys who by the nature of what they were doing, certainly were never going to tell me they were in the IRA. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Over the years, it became very secretive and very closed off, I think, and very wrong-directed. But yeah, their lives did affect me. You know, the guy who I wrote the play with was interned, you know, in jail in Northern Ireland. I wrote the film with, was interned. And all that stuff does affect you, you know. And I, you know, it's like kind of like a joke, you know, everybody's saying, you know, the IRA were criminal, this, that, and the other. And, you know, suddenly, like, what? Well, it's as if, you know, a cloud rained on Belfast one day, and out of this rain, you know, everybody became a criminal, you know? And it's like just avoidance of the reality, you know?
Your new film, The Boxer, has to do with the IRA. So did your film, In the Name of the Father. I'm wondering if making art during the Troubles has affected your view of what art should do, what movies should do, or what theater should do, because I know you've run a theater group, too.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I don't consider... you know, what I do is artistic, and sometimes people will turn it into propaganda on one side or the
mm-hmm.
other, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I can't avoid that, really. But I also can't avoid that I have this position... And, you know, the ability to make films. And if I didn't make them about these subjects, I'd feel worse than I do, you know, because I think I'd be avoiding what's in front of my face, you know.
Jim Sheridan, he directed and co-wrote the film The Boxer. One of the songs heard in the film is Danny Boy. Here's Rosemary Clooney's version.
Danny boy, the pipes are calling from glen to glen and down the mountainside. The summer's gone and all the roses falling. It's you must go, and I must bide. But come ye back when summer's in the meadow, or when the valley's hushed and white with snow. It's I'll be there in sunshine or in shadow. Oh, Danny boy, oh, Danny boy, I I love you so.
Rosemary Clooney from her album Demicentennial. Coming up, Victoria Williams' first new CD in 3 years. This is Fresh Air. Victoria Williams' Musings of a Creek Dipper is her first new collection of material in more than 3 years, during which time she struggled with an on-again, off-again battle with multiple sclerosis, for which she had been diagnosed in 1992. Williams joined this summer's Lilith Tour for 10 dates. Rock critic Ken Tucker says that Musings of a Creek Dipper has a simple directness to its art that gives its music a special force.
Here's what happened. The other night I woke at 4 in the morning. I was at Fred's house, on the couch, on the porch, and the moon was full. I walked over to the corral. There saw the magic. The horse was kneeling on the ground, holding court with 15 rabbits. Cashmere's corn.
In the best of Victoria Williams' songs, as on that one called Cashmere's Corn, she cobbles together an idiosyncratic combination of folk and country music, plus the sort of low-key rock and roll that Graham Parsons of the Byrds might have come up with. She takes her time getting to her point, drifting off conversationally to abandon realistic imagery, to come up with visions of, as she sings on this song, horses that kneel to hold court with 15 rabbits. In the past, the results have often been precious or coy, but on this album, they cohere as urgent messages from the heart.
When I was a little kid, I'd have to sit like most kids did, counting as the train cars passed, waiting for the very last. Oh, to see the old man waving his overalls and his hair all gray, smiling in the sun. Nowadays it ain't no use, there's no caboose. Can't understand how they can take the job from a kind old man, steal the joy from a young child's heart just when it gets to the groovy part. Nowadays it ain't no use, there's no caboose. They ramble over mountains, they crawl. Why they used to go to every town, one and all.
Now, there's a whole song built around the idea that Victoria is really disappointed and kind of angry that most trains that run past her house don't have cabooses on them anymore. Lots of folk-based young singer-songwriters try for a kind of willed nostalgia, to dramatize a regret they've never really experienced, because they know it makes for good drama. With Williams, The yearning for a caboose seems as heartfelt and intense as her desire in other songs for a good marriage and good work to do. In the past, I must admit that Williams' high, curling voice has sometimes driven me a little crazy with its cuteness and apparent affectations. On this album, I love the way she's playing around with that voice, acknowledging its mannerisms and using them for emotional payoffs. Raised in Shreveport, Louisiana, Williams launched her music career in Los Angeles, where she found a kindred spirit in mannered eccentricity with producer-composer Van Dyke Parks and with Peter Case, leader of the terrific L.A. punk-pop band The Plimsolls. She married Case, but it didn't last. Williams has relocated for medical and spiritual reasons to Joshua Tree, California, not far from where Gram Parsons' ashes were scattered, and where she now lives with her new husband, Mark Olson, of the band The Jayhawks. There, Williams is making music that uses what she calls the occasional flapping around of her hands to make precise, meticulous music about unruly, difficult to pin down, yet lyrically precise feelings.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Musings of a Creek Dipper by Victoria Williams. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Bob Purdick, Al Banks, and Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.